but that didn't make it any less awkward to hear via a third party. "Would you tell her," he raised his hands to Mira Jo's quote marks, "that loving a loony is exactly what I like best?" Murray sat in the car park of Highfield, leaning back against the headrest. He should have known better than to have tried to surprise Sarah. She was unpredictable at the best of times, but predictably so in the mornings. He would try again on his way home from work. So now what? He had 2 hours before his shift started, and no desire to go back to an empty house and watch the minutes tick by. The fridge was full, the garden tidy, and the house clean. Murray considered his options. "Yes," he said aloud, as he was inclined to do. "Why not?" His time was his own. He could do what he wanted with it. He headed out of town across the downs, pressing his foot hard against the floor for a burst of speed you never got on buses. A shortage of parking at the police station meant public transport was often more convenient for work, but Murray enjoyed driving, and he put on the radio and hummed along to a track he only half knew. The threatened rain hadn't yet materialized, but the clouds hung low above the hills, and when the sea hove into view, it was flecked with angry white tips. The car park was near empty, save a half dozen cars, and Murray found 80p among the loose change he kept in the otherwise redundant ashtray, and popped the ticket on the dash. A large sign next to the pay and display machine gave the contact number for the Samaritans, and as Murray walked towards the coastal path, he passed a series of further signs. "It helps to talk. You are not alone." Could a sign make a difference? Might a person, hell-bent on suicide, stop to take in a message meant for them? "You are not alone." For every person who fell to their death off Beachy Head, there were a dozen more who didn't. A dozen more who lost their nerve, had a change of heart, encountered one of the volunteers who patrolled the cliffs, and reluctantly agreed to join them for a cup of tea instead of carrying out their plan. It didn't end there, though, did it? An intervention was a comma, not a full stop. All the tea, all the conversation, all the support in the world might not change what happened the next day, or the day after that. Murray thought of the poor chaplain who'd found Caroline Johnson on the cliff edge, her rucksack weighed down with stones. How must he have felt to learn that the woman he'd talked down from suicide had gone straight back to the same spot and jumped anyway? Had she been with someone that day? Had the chaplain been so focused on saving Caroline's life that he had neglected to see a figure in the shadows, keeping well back? Was Anna's mother pushed? Perhaps not physically, but could someone have forced Caroline into taking her own life? The headland rose above Murray, each stride taking him higher above sea level. Local folklore suggested malignant ley lines converged at Beachy Head, drawing those susceptible to such things to their death. Murray held no truck with magic and mystery, but it was hard to ignore the power of the place. The expanse of grass ended abruptly, in bright white cliffs, the contrast muted by the mist that swirled around the lighthouse below. As the clouds shifted, Murray caught glimpses of grey sea, and he felt a rush of vertigo, stepping backwards, even though he was 12 feet or more from the crumbling edges. Caroline had come here to die. That much had been clear from the chaplain's testimony. Yet the implication in the anonymous anniversary card was clear. Her suicide was not as it seemed. Murray pictured Caroline Johnson standing where he now stood. Had she wanted to die? Or been willing to die? There was a subtle but important distinction. Willing to die so that someone else would be spared. Her daughter? Perhaps Anna herself was the key to all this. Could Caroline Johnson have taken her own life because someone threatened to hurt her daughter if she didn't? Far from clearing his head, Beachy Head was sending him around in circles. In the center of a well-trodden patch of grass was a stone plinth topped with a slate slab. Murray read the engraving, his lips moving silently. "Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty." Beneath the psalm, a final reminder. God is always greater than all of our troubles. Murray felt something well up inside him. He turned abruptly from the plinth, looked one last time at where the cliffs gave way to oblivion, and then marched back towards the car park, angry he had let it get to him. He had come for research purposes, he told himself, not to get maudlin. He had come to see where Anna Johnson's parents had died, to fix the scene in his mind, thinking it might have changed since he was last there. It hadn't. It had been one of the patrol volunteers who had found Sarah. She'd been sitting on the edge of the cliff, her feet dangling into oblivion. She hadn't wanted to kill herself, she'd told the chaplain. She just didn't want to be in the world anymore. There was a difference, she'd insisted. Murray had understood that. He wouldn't change his wife for the world, but he wished so much he could change the world for his wife. Murray had picked up the call, left work, and driven to the pub at Beachy Head, where Sarah was sitting with a woman whose dog collar was all but hidden beneath her waterproofs. The landlord was a quiet, thoughtful man, experienced in the difference between a stiff drink and Dutch courage, quick to call the police if the latter looked as though it would end badly. He had retired discreetly to the other end of the pub, while Sarah had cried on Murray's shoulder. Beachy Head hadn't changed. It never would. It was, would always be, a beautiful, haunting, agonizing place, at once uplifting and destroying. Murray parked the car in the street behind the police station, checked the time, and took out his access card. A pair of response officers were jogging down the corridor, nodding their thanks as Murray swung open the door for them, before getting into a marked car parked in the backyard. Within seconds, they were out of the gate, wheels spinning as they rounded the corner. Murray stood until the sound of the siren had all but disappeared, a barely there smile on his face. There was nothing like a blue light run for getting the blood pumping. The Criminal Investigation Department, or CID, was at the end of a long corridor. In Murray's day, there had been 5 or 6 small offices on each side, but by the time he'd retired, most of the internal walls had been demolished to create open-plan workspaces. Officers were expected to hot desk now, Murray knew, and he was grateful the concept hadn't been mooted while he was still on the department. How could you solve a jigsaw puzzle when you had to keep packing away the pieces? Detective Sergeant James Kennedy looked up as Murray entered, his face showing genuine warmth. He shook Murray's hand vigorously.
How the devil are you? Still on the front desk? Lower Mead's Nick, isn't it?
That's the one.
Rather you than me, James shuddered. Soon as I get my pension, I'm out of here. You won't catch me back under the cosh. Working Christmas instead of watching the kids open their stockings. It's a mug's game, right?
James Kennedy was in his early 30s. He'd arrived on CID 2 months before Murray's leaving due, and now there he was, leading a team, and no doubt one of the most experienced detectives in the office. He might think his retirement, still years in the future, would never involve a uniform. But wait till he got there, Murray thought. 30 years left a gap that was hard to fill. James took in Murray's civvies.
In early? You're keen?
I was just passing. Thought I'd pop in and see how things were. There was a moment's hesitation while the stark reality of Murray's empty life hung in the air between them, before James rallied.
Well, I'm glad you did. It was good to see you. I'll put the kettle on.
As James clattered about in the corner of the office, where a kettle and tea tray on top of a fridge formed a makeshift kitchen, Murray looked at the ongoing cases on the whiteboard.
I see Owen Healy's still outstanding.
James put 2 mugs of tea on the desk, the bags still bobbing about in them. Murray fished his out and dropped it in the bin by his feet.
He always used to run with the Matthews lads when they were kids. Lived on the estate behind Wood Green. They're still thick as the proverbial.
There was an awkward pause.
Oh, ha, right. We better check that out then. Good job you swung by.
James clapped Murray on the shoulder with enforced joviality, and Murray wished he hadn't said anything. He might be retired, but he still worked for the police. He still heard things,
still knew things. He didn't need to be humored. People always did, though. Not only because he was old, but because... How's Sarah? There it was. The head, cocked to one side. The, thank God it's you and not me, look in his eyes. James's wife was at home, looking after their two children. She wasn't in a mental health unit for the 100th time. James wouldn't be rushing home from work because his wife was kneeling in the kitchen with her head in the oven. Murray checked himself. No one knew what went on behind closed doors. She's fine. Should be home soon. Murray had no idea if that was true. He had long given up asking. Instead, seeing Sarah's frequent stays at Highfield, whether voluntary or not, as a chance for him to gather his strength to have her back home. Respite. Actually, while I'm here, I was going to ask you about a job. James looked relieved to be back on more familiar territory. All ears, mate. Your team dealt with a couple of suicides at Beachy Head in May and December last year. Tom and Caroline Johnson, husband and wife. She killed herself at the same spot he did. James stared at his desk, drumming his fingers as he tried to place the job. Johnson's cars, right? That's it. Do you remember much about them? They were identical. Copycat suicides. In fact, we were a bit worried it might spark a load more. The papers really went to town on it. But, touch wood, it's been quiet on that front. The last jumper was a couple of weeks ago. Got blown into the cliffs on his way down. James winced. Anything else strike you as odd? Murray was keen to stay on track. About the Johnsons, in what way? People topping themselves at Beachy Head is hardly unusual. I seem to remember the coroner's reports being fairly cut and dried. They were, I just thought. You know how you have a feeling about a job sometimes? Something not right. As though the truth is hiding in plain sight, but you can't quite get hold of it. Sure. James was nodding politely, but there was no spark of recognition. His generation of detectives didn't work on feelings. They worked on facts, forensics. It wasn't their fault. The courts didn't go a bundle on intuition either. Murray did. In his experience, if something smelled like a fish and tasted like a fish, it was almost certainly a fish, even if it didn't look like one. But you didn't feel like that about these jobs. Pretty standard stuff, mate. They were in and out of the office within a couple of weeks each time. He leaned forward and lowered his voice, even though there was no one else in the office. Not exactly taxing stuff for CID, am I right? Murray smiled politely. He supposed an open and shut suicide didn't present much of a challenge to a team of hungry detectives with an array of rapes and robberies on their desks. It had been different for Murray. His motivation had been people, not crimes. Victims, witnesses, even offenders. They'd all fascinated him. He had felt, still felt, compelled to investigate the mysteries in their lives. How he wished he had been sitting at James's desk when the Johnson suicides had come in. Murray stirred himself. I'd better get off. Things to do, people to see, right? James clapped him on the shoulder again. Why the interest in the Johnsons? That was the point at which Murray should show him Anna Johnson's anonymous card. The point at which he should officially hand over the job to CID and go back to his front desk job. Murray looked at the list of jobs on the whiteboard, at the piles of ongoing files on each detective's desk. Would James prioritize this one? A job with no clear answers, handed to him by a retired cop. No reason, Murray said, before he'd properly thought it through. Idle curiosity. I saw the name on an old briefing sheet. I bought a car from them a few years ago. Right. Cool. James's eyes flicked to his screen. I'll let you get on. Have a good Christmas. Anna Johnson was vulnerable. In a little over a year, she'd lost both her parents and had a baby. She felt threatened and confused, and if this job was going to be investigated, then it needed to be done properly, not given a cursory glance before being filed again. Great to see you, mate. Keep up the good work.
James half stood as Murray left the office. He was back in his seat before the older man had reached the door, the Johnson case already forgotten. Murray would quietly investigate Caroline Johnson's death, and the moment he had concrete evidence of foul play, he'd come back to D.S. Kennedy. Until then, he was on his own. Chapter 16. Anna.
It just seems a bit over the top, that's all I'm saying.
Not to me. We stand in the open doorway, Ella in her car seat between us. Mark looks at his watch, even though he only just checked the time.
You don't have to come. You can drop me at the police station and go on to work if you'd rather.
Well, don't be silly, of course I'll come.
Silly? I'd hardly call a dead rabbit.
I didn't mean the rabbit.
Christ, Anna, I meant, don't be silly. I'm not going to leave you to go to the police on your own.
Mark exhales noisily and stands squarely facing me.
I'm on your side, you know.
I know.
I'm sorry.
There's a shout from next door.
Morning?
Robert Drake is standing outside his house, his hands on the railings between our driveways.
Bit early, isn't it?
Mark slips easily into jovial neighbor mode, going down the steps to greet Robert through the railings.
First one off for 6 years. I'm going to milk it.
I don't blame you.
6 years.
I watch them shake hands through the railings.
Still on for Christmas drinks at mine?
Absolutely,
Mark says, with far more enthusiasm than I'd be able to muster. Robert holds a party every year. He cancelled it last year, out of respect for my parents, but the invitation for this year's dropped through the door a couple of weeks ago. Presumably my mourning period is over.
What can we bring? Just yourselves, unless you want soft drinks. Not many of those around. Ha!
Dad and Billy used to play golf with Robert from time to time, but Mum never joined them. She said Robert was smug. I look at him now, at his expensive shirt and his confident stance, and think she was right. Robert Drake has the innate arrogance of someone so on top of their professional game that they adopt the same position in their private life. Fuck off, Robert. The voice in my head is so clear, I think for a moment I've said it out loud. I imagine Mark's face, and Robert's, and stifle a snort of laughter that erupts from nowhere. I think perhaps I'm going mad. The way I think my mum did after Dad died. Laughing at things that weren't funny, crying at things that weren't sad. My world feels tipped upside down, and this man next door, with his cheery Christmas greetings and his jokes about soft drinks, feels not just insignificant, but inappropriate after the events of the last 24 hours. My mother was murdered, I want to tell him. Now someone's threatening me. I don't, of course. But it occurs to me that Robert, with his penchant for wandering outside to chat to the neighbors, might have seen something useful. I join Mark by the railings.
Did you see anyone outside our house this morning?
Robert stops short, his festive cheer dimmed by the intensity of my stare.
Not that I recall.
He's a tall man, but not broad, like Mark. He stoops slightly, and I imagine him leaning over the operating table, scalpel in hand. I shiver. Imagine that same hand slicing open a rabbit.
Were you outside the house, late last night?
The abruptness of my question is followed by an awkward pause. Robert looks at Mark, even though it's me who asked the question.
Should I have been? Someone put a rabbit on our doormat, Mark explains. There was blood all over the steps. We wondered if you might have seen anything.
Good God, a rabbit? What a peculiar...
But why?
I examine his face, looking for any sign that he's faking. You didn't see anyone. Even as I ask, I'm not sure what answer I'm expecting.
Yes, I watched someone put a mutilated rabbit outside your house, but didn't think to ask what the hell they were doing. Or, yes, I put it there as a joke, ha-ha. An early Christmas present.
I wasn't back till late last night. Both your cars were in the driveway, but there were no lights on. and I'm afraid I had a lie-in this morning. Off till New Year.
I know. Lucky bugger, eh?
This is stupid. Robert Drake is the sort of person who starts neighborhood watch schemes and reports cold callers. If he had seen someone putting a rabbit on our step, he'd have told us. As for putting it there himself, the man's a doctor, not a psychopath. I turn to Mark. We should get going.
Sure.
He picks up Ella's car seat and takes it to his car, strapping it in with no sense of urgency. I sit in the back next to her. I don't think Mark is taking this seriously. My parents were murdered. How much more proof does he want? The anonymous card, a dead rabbit. These aren't normal events. He stands for a while outside the closed car door, then moves away. I hear the crunch of gravel underfoot. I stroke Ella's cheek with one outstretched finger and wait for Mark to lock the front door. I have a sudden memory of waiting in the car for my parents, sitting in the back like this, while Dad tapped the steering wheel and Mum rushed back to the house for something she'd forgotten. I wish you could meet them, I say to Ella. When I left university, I desperately wanted a place of my own. I'd had a taste of independence, seen a world outside of Eastbourne, and I liked it. But the charity sector is built for job satisfaction, not salary goals, and the property ladder remained stubbornly out of my grasp. I moved back home and never left. Dad was fond of reminding me I didn't know how good I had it.
Kicked out at 16 to learn the trade I was. You'd never have caught my old man doing laundry for Bill and me past our teens.
I was fairly confident that Grandad Johnson had never been near a washing machine in his life, his wife having been the sort of woman who reveled in homemaking and shooed intruders from the kitchen. I worked 12-hour days for years. By the time I was your age, I had a flat in Soho and a wallet full of 50s. I exchanged a conspiratorial grin with Mum. Neither of us pointed out that it had been Grandad who had lined up the apprenticeship at a friend's garage, and Granny who had sent food parcels up with the trade platers. Not to mention the fact that in 1983, it was still possible to buy a flat in London for 50 grand. I changed the subject before he claimed he'd been sent up chimneys as a schoolboy. I was never academic, but I'd inherited my parents' work ethic. I admired them both for the hours they put in to making the family business a success, and did my best to emulate them. Find a job you love, Dad was fond of saying, and you'll never do a day's work in your life. The trouble was, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I got a place at Warwick to do sociology, scraped a 2-2, and left with no clearer idea. The first step on my career path was an accidental one. I took a job with Save the Children, collected a red body warmer and clipboard, and traipsed the streets, knocking on doors. Some people were kind, others less so. But I soon discovered I did have a little of my parents' charm after all. I recruited more monthly donors that first month than the rest of the team put together. A temporary promotion to regional supervisor ended when a position became vacant for the national post, and I slid into a desk that felt a world away from the exam halls of an undiagnosed dyslexic teen who would never amount to anything.
Chip off the old block, Dad said.
I worked closely with the fundraising team, thought up innovative ideas for raising awareness, and looked after my 300-strong team of door knockers across the country. I defended them fiercely from middle-class complaints about chugging and praised each and every one of my staff for the contribution they made to children around the globe. I loved the job I'd found, but it wasn't well paid. Living at home was the only option. Besides, uncool though it might have been to admit it, I liked living at home. Not for the clean washing or the home-cooked meals or my dad's infamous wine cellar, but because my parents were genuinely good company. They made me laugh. They were interested and interesting. We chatted late into the night about plans, politics, people. We discussed our problems. There were no secrets, or so they pretended. I think of the vodka bottle beneath my parents' desk, the others secreted around the house, of the kitchen table littered with empty wine bottles, yet always spotless by the time I got up in the morning. Towards the end of my first term at Warwick, I spent the weekend with Sam, a friend from Halls, at her parents' house. The absence of wine at dinner felt strange, like they'd dished up a meal without knives or forks. A few weeks later, I asked Sam if her parents minded her drinking.
Why would they? Or aren't they teetotal?
Sam laughed.
Teetotal? You should see Mum on the sherries at Christmas.
My cheeks burned. I thought, they didn't drink when I came to stay. She shrugged.
Can't say I noticed. Sometimes they drink, sometimes they don't, like most people, I guess.
I guess so. Most people didn't drink every evening. Most people didn't fix a gin and tonic when they got home from work, saying it was 6 o'clock somewhere, right? Most people.
All set?
Mark gets into the car and puts on his seatbelt. He looks at me in the rearview mirror, then twists around to see me properly. He clears his throat, a subconscious habit I recognize from our early meetings. It's a form of punctuation, a full stop between what's been said and what he's about to say. A way of saying, listen to me now, this is important. After we've been to the police. He hesitates. Yes. We could make an appointment for you to see someone. I raise an eyebrow. See someone. The middle-class euphemism for go find a shrink, you're going nuts. I don't need to see another counsellor. Anniversaries can do funny things. Hilarious, I joke, but Mark doesn't smile. He turns back around and starts the car. Think about it, at least. There's nothing to think about. It's the police I need, not a shrink. But as we pull out of the drive, I take a sharp breath and lean across Ella to put a hand on the window. Maybe I do need a shrink. For a second, that woman walking. It isn't Mum, of course, but I'm shocked by the intensity of my disappointment, by the very fact that a part of me thought it might be. Yesterday, on the anniversary of her death, I felt her presence so strongly that today I'm conjuring up ghosts where none exist. And yet, I have the strangest feeling. Who says ghosts don't exist? Doctors? Psychiatrists? Mark? Maybe it's possible to summon the dead. Maybe it's possible they return of their own accord. Maybe, just maybe, my mother has a message for me. I share none of this with Mark, but I stare out of the window as we drive to the station, willing myself to see ghosts, to see some sort of sign. If Mum's trying to tell me what really happened the day she died, I'm listening. Chapter 17. I've been here too long. The longer I stay, the more likely it is that someone will see me. But I have to do this now. It could be my only chance. Mark straps the baby into the back of the car, and Anna slides into the adjacent seat. Mark closes the car door. He stands for a second with his palms flat on the roof of the car. Like that, he's concealed from Anna, but I can see the anxiety on his face. Is he worried about Anna? The baby? Or something else? He walks back to the side of the house, where Robert is lingering, pretending to move some pots about. I feel panic building inside me, even though he can't touch me, can't even see me. The two men talk in low tones through the railings, and I wonder if Anna can hear the same snippets I do. Still grieving. Very difficult. A touch of postnatal depression. I wait. They drive away. Robert abandons his plant pots and goes back inside. And then, it's time. A single breath later, I'm through the locked door, and standing in the hall. Instantly, I'm overwhelmed with sensation, assaulted by memories I never imagined would have lingered. Painting the skirting boards, kneeling awkwardly over my growing bump, piling duvets on the stairs for a pint-sized Anna to sledge down, you egging her on, me with my fingers over my eyes. Playing happy families, hiding how we really felt. How easily life changes. how easily happiness disintegrates. The drinking, the shouting, the fights. I kept it from Anna. I could at least do that for her. I check myself. The time for being maudlin is long gone, too late now to dwell on the past. I move quickly and silently through the house, my touch feather light. I leave no mess, no prints, no trace. I want to see the papers Anna put to one side, my diary, the photographs that only tell a story when you know the way it ends. I look for the key that will tell everyone why I had to die. I find nothing. In the study, I work my way efficiently through the drawers. I ignore the stab of nostalgia that pierces deeper with each trinket and notebook I pick up. You can't take it with you. That's what they say. I remember an old school project of Anna's on the grave goods selected by ancient Egyptians, designed to smooth the deceased's passage to the afterlife. Anna spent weeks on a painting of a sarcophagus, surrounded by the carefully drawn images of her own precious belongings. Her iPod, salt and vinegar crisps, 6 packets. Portraits she'd drawn of you and me. A favorite scarf in case she got cold. I smile at the memory and consider what I would have taken, had it been possible. What would have made my afterlife more bearable? There is no key. Not in any of the bags dotted about downstairs, or in the drawer of the dresser in the hall where everything accumulates when it doesn't have a home. What has Anna done with it? Chapter 18. Murray. I found my mother's diary from last year. Anna handed him a thick A4 diary. I thought it might help piece together her movements. They were sitting in the kitchenette behind the front desk at Lower Mead's police station, where Murray had first spoken to Anna Johnson. Anna's partner, Mark, was with her, and together they had reported one of the strangest occurrences Murray had ever been asked to investigate. Mark Hemmings had thick, dark hair and glasses that were currently pushed up on his forehead. He was sitting back in his chair, with one ankle on the knee of his other leg. His right arm rested on the back of Anna's chair. Anna Johnson took up half the space of her partner. She sat on the edge of her seat, leaning forwards with her legs crossed and her hands clasped together as though she were in church. There were various leaflets and business cards filed within the pages of the diary, and as Murray opened the front cover, a photograph fell out. Anna reached for it. "Sorry, I put it there so it didn't get creased. I was going to get it framed." "Your mother?" "There, in the yellow dress. And that's her friend Alicia. She died of an asthma attack when she was 33. Her daughter Laura is Mum's goddaughter." Murray remembered the pocket notebook entry from the attending officer. "Laura Barnes, goddaughter." The women, girls really, in the photo, were laughing outside a pub, their arms entangled so they looked like extensions of each other. In the background of the photo was a table of young men, one of whom was looking across at Alicia and Caroline admiringly. Murray could make out a wagon and horses on the swinging sign outside the building behind them. "Funny place for a holiday. About as far as you can get from the sea. But Mum said they had the best time." "Lovely photo. You never met Anna's parents, Mr. Hemmings?" "Sadly not. They'd both passed away before we met. In fact, it was because of them we met at all." Instinctively, both Mark and Anna look at their daughter, who, Murray supposed, would not have existed without the tragedy that had befallen the family. "I'll speak to a crime scene investigator about the rabbit, but without examining it." "I'm sorry, we didn't think." Anna shot a look at her partner. "I'll just leave it there next time, shall I?" Mark said. He spoke mildly, but with an undertone that suggested this was a conversation already had at least once. "Let the flies have a really good go at it." "It can't be helped. I've submitted the anniversary card to forensics. They'll check for fingerprints and DNA, and try to enhance the postmark so we have a better idea of where it came from. And I'll take a look through this diary. Thank you." Murray passed the photo back to Anna, but she didn't put it in her bag. She held it in both hands, staring at the image as though she could bring it to life. thinking I see her. She looked up. Mark moved his arm from the back of her chair to her shoulders. His lips were pressed tightly together as Anna tried to explain.
At least, not see her exactly, but feel her. I think she might be trying to tell me something. Does that sound mad?
Mark spoke softly, as much to Murray as to Anna. It's very common for people who are grieving to imagine they see their loved ones. It's a manifestation of emotion. You want to see them so badly you think,
what if I'm not imagining it?
There was an awkward pause. Murray felt as though he were intruding, and wondered if he should fabricate a reason to leave the couple alone. Before he could move, Anna turned to him.
What do you think? Do you believe in ghosts? In an afterlife?
Police officers were, by nature, a cynical breed. Throughout his service, Murray had kept his thoughts on ghosts to himself, avoiding the ribbing that would inevitably have ensued. Even now, he didn't commit. One's belief or otherwise in the supernatural was a personal matter, like religion or politics, and not one to be debated in a side room of a police station.
I'm open to it.
There were more things in heaven and earth, Shakespeare had said, than anyone could ever imagine. But that didn't make Murray's job any easier. He couldn't go to CID with a report that Anna Johnson was being haunted by a murdered relative. He leaned forward.
Do you get a sense of what she might be trying to tell you?
Murray ignored the almost tangible disparagement that was emanating from Mark Hemmings.
I'm sorry. It's just a feeling.
It was going to take more than a feeling to convince CID that Tom and Caroline Johnson had been murdered. Nisha Kaur had been a crime scene investigator back when they were called Scenes of Crime officers.
Same shit, different job title, she'd say cheerfully. Give it another 10 years and some bright spark upstairs will be rebranding us all SOCOs again.
Not that Nish would be there in 10 years' time. She had been new in post when Murray was a young detective, joining the force with a BTEC in photography, a strong stomach, and the enviable ability to get on with everyone. 30 years later, she was principal CSI, responsible for the force forensic team, and counting down to her own retirement.
Pet photography, she said, when Murray asked her plans. She laughed at the surprise on his face. The uniform's better, there's less blood, and if you tried being depressed when there's a kitten in the room. I can pick and choose my jobs, no more arsey punters for me, and work my own hours. All very low-key. More of a hobby than a job.
They were sitting in the closed canteen, where a triptych of vending machines served the weekend workers.
Sounds like a good plan.
Privately, Murray doubted Nish could do anything on a low-key basis. Within 18 months of retirement, she'd be working flat out again.
What are you doing over Christmas?
On call, you?
Nothing special. Quiet one, you know.
Is Sarah...
Nish didn't do the head tilt.
At Highfield. Voluntarily this time. She's fine.
It sounded insincere, even to Murray. You'd have thought he would have found Sarah's admissions easier as time went by, but the last few occasions had drained him more than ever before. He was getting older, he supposed, finding stress harder to handle.
What did you want to see me about?
Nish, perceptive as ever, changing tack.
How much blood is there in a rabbit?
It was a measure of the variety of Nish's job and the breadth of her experience that the question provoked no surprise.
A couple of 100 milliliters, if that. A small glassful, she added, seeing Murray's blank look.
Enough to cover 3 steps.
Nish scratched her chin.
You're going to have to give me a bit more to go on.
Murray didn't mention the suicides at first. He recounted the report that Anna and Mark had made, and how Anna had been convinced the rabbit hadn't been placed there by an animal.
I'd say she could be right.
Murray leaned forward in anticipation, and Nish held up a warning finger. This is totally off the record and entirely hypothetical, understood? Without photos and without examining the scene, it's impossible for me to make a professional judgment.
But,
blood, in the quantity we're talking about, doesn't pour out of a prone rabbit. It seeps and it coagulates. So although 150 mil tipped on the floor would make a hell of a mess, ever dropped a glass of wine, the same amount oozing from a rabbit would congeal long before it dripped onto the step below. Most of it would be caught in the fur. Right. So someone deliberately tipped blood on the other steps to make a more impressive crime scene. Sounds like it. The bigger question is why. Nish eyed Murray, her head tilted slightly to one side. There's more to this than you're telling me, isn't there? It wasn't a question. There were two suicides at Beachy Head last year. Tom and Caroline Johnson. They owned the car showroom on the corner of Main Street. Nish snapped her fingers. Left a black Audi in the car park, right? Rocks in his rucksack. You're good. That was Tom Johnson. His wife, Caroline, died 7 months later, exactly a year ago. Same place, identical method. Anna Johnson is their daughter. He passed Nish a plastic evidence bag containing the anonymous anniversary card, together with a photograph of the pieced-together card. Suicide, Nish read aloud. Think again. She looked up. Very dramatic. The suggestion being that she was murdered. That's certainly how Anna Johnson interpreted it. This morning she opened the door to find the rabbit smeared across their top step. Beats dog shit through the letterbox. What do you think? Other than the fact that it's a waste of a nice rabbit pie, I think it's fishy. What does CID say? Not a lot. Nish had known Murray a long time. Oh, Murray. I'm doing the background work, that's all. You know what's the idea like nowadays? Stretched to buggery. I'll package it up for the DI as soon as there's something concrete to go on. Fingerprints, for example. He gave Nish a winning smile and pushed the exhibit bag closer to her. Nish pushed it back. Not without a budget code, I'm afraid. Couldn't you put it through on the original job? You know I'm not supposed to do that. She lost both her parents, Nish. She's a new mother, desperately trying to hold it all together without Mum there to give her moral support. You're going soft in your old age. Whereas you're still hard as nails, of course. What was it you were saying about kittens? He pushed the evidence bag back across the table. This time, she took it. Chapter 19. The rocking chair was a wedding present from my parents. It has a high back and smooth, curved arms, exactly the right height for sleepy nighttime feeds. It arrived with a red ribbon, two soft cushions, and a note that said, "For the nursery." I spent hours in this chair. You never got up. Men didn't in those days. And I was afraid to turn on the light in case it kept Anna awake, so I rocked back and forth in the dark, willing her to sleep. When Anna moved out of the nursery, I brought the rocking chair downstairs, where it divided its time between the kitchen and the sitting room. But now it is back here, in Anna's nursery. In our granddaughter's nursery. The room is large, extravagant for a baby, especially one currently sleeping in her parents' bedroom, judging by the Moses basket on Anna's side of the bed. Above the white cot is a string of pink and white bunting, with the name Ella picked out in pale green. Adjacent to the cot is a chest of drawers and, on the opposite wall, a matching wardrobe and a changing table with gingham-lined baskets filled with nappies and talcum powder. I mean only to peek inside. I think it's unlikely I'll find the key here. But my feet find their way across the soft grey carpet to the rocking chair. My rocking chair. Back and forth, back and forth. The light low. The view across the rooftops the same as it's been for 26 years. Anna in my arms. They called it the baby blues then. It felt more than that. I was overwhelmed. Frightened. I wanted to call Alicia, the only one of my friends who might have understood, but I couldn't bring myself to pick up the phone. I had everything she didn't. A husband, a big house, money. What right did I have to cry? I've stayed here too long. I need to get on. I need to get out. Downstairs, I check the kitchen, automatically straightening the tea towel hanging on the arga. There's a pile of magazines on the table, and a scattering of post dumped in the empty fruit bowl on the island. I don't find the key I'm looking for. There's a scuffle of paws from the utility room. Rita. My breath catches in my throat, and although I don't make a sound, I hear her whine. She can sense I'm here. I pause, my fingers resting lightly on the door handle. Surely being seen by a dog isn't the same as being seen by humans. Rita whines again. She knows I'm here. Walking away would be cruel. A quick hello, and then I'll leave. Where's the harm in that? She can't tell anyone she's seen a ghost. The door is barely open an inch when it's forced open by a barrel of fur moving so fast it tumbles over itself and twice rolls along the tiled floor before standing again. Rita. She jumps backwards, her hackles up, and her tail wagging as though she doesn't know how she should be feeling. She barks once, twice, jumps forward and then back. I remember her growling at shadows in the hedgerows on our evening walks, and wonder what she saw then that I dismissed as nothing. I drop to my knees and hold out a hand. She knows my smell, but my appearance is confusing her. Good girl, Rita. The sob in my voice catches me unawares. Rita's ears prick up in recognition, and the ridge of bristling fur along her spine subsides. Her tail is a blur, taking her back end with it. Another whine. Yes, it's me, Rita. There's a good girl. Come on. She needs no further invitation, satisfied that, contrary to first impressions, her mistress is indeed in her kitchen. She throws herself at me, licking furiously at my face, and leaning so heavily against me, I have to put out a hand to steady myself. I sit with her, my quest forgotten, as I bury my face in her fur. I feel the advent of tears, and I swallow hard and refuse to let them fall. When Rita arrived from Cyprus, she'd been in a rescue center for 8 months. She was affectionate and gentle, but had such acute separation anxiety that even leaving the room was an ordeal. The first time we went out, she howled so loudly we could still hear her at the end of the street, and I had to turn back and leave you to go on alone. Gradually, Rita realized she was here for keeps, that if we went out, we'd be back with treats for being such a brave girl. She still greeted us on our return with excitement and relief, but the howling ceased, and she settled into a calm and happy dog. Guilt seeps through me as I imagine how she must have felt the day I didn't come home. Did she wait by the front door? Run the length of the hall and back, whining to see me? Did Anna stroke her? Reassure her I'd be back soon? All the while wondering herself what had happened. Worrying as much as Rita. More. Rita suddenly sits up, nose in the air and ears alert. I freeze. She's heard something. Sure enough, a second later, I hear it too. The crunch of gravel. Voices. A key in the lock. Chapter 20. Anna. Mark insists on coming with us into the house, instead of dropping us at the curb. So you are worried, I say, as he carries Ella's car seat indoors. Now that you know it wasn't a fox that left that rabbit. There's a chill in the hall, and I turn up the thermostat until I hear the heating kick in. He actually said they couldn't be certain either way. Without photos, you mean? Without forensics. He gives me a look, and I bite back a further retort. Bickering won't help. But yes, I'm worried, he says, and his tone is serious. I feel childishly vindicated, but Mark isn't done. I'm worried about you. He shuts the front door. What you said at the police station, about feeling your mother's presence. He doesn't finish, and I don't help him out. It's a perfectly normal part of the grieving process, but it could be a sign you're not coping, And then there's Ella and all the hormones involved in becoming a mother.
I wait for several beats. You think I'm going mad?
No, I don't think that.
What if I like feeling as though Mum's still here?
Mark nods thoughtfully and rubs a forefinger across his lips, his thumb beneath his chin, his listening face. It makes me feel like a patient, not a partner, a case study, not the mother of his child.
What if I want to see ghosts? Sorry, what if I want to have post-bereavement hallucinatory experiences?
The correction is sarcastic, and I see hurt in Mark's eyes, but I'm past the point where I can calm myself down.
I'll see you later.
He doesn't kiss me goodbye, and I don't blame him. He shuts the door and I hear the jangle of his keys as he double locks it behind him. I wonder fleetingly if he thinks he's keeping the danger out or shutting it in.
Your mother is an idiot, Ella, I tell her.
She blinks at me.
Why did I have to be so unpleasant?
Mark's worried, that's all. Personally and professionally. Wasn't it precisely his compassion that attracted me to him? Now I'm seeing that same trait as a flaw. I shiver, bend down to feel the radiator. It's warming up, but it's still so cold in here. I laugh out loud. All the ghostly clichés are coming out now. But it's unconvincing, even to me, because it isn't just the temperature that makes me feel as though someone else is in the room. It's my mother's perfume. Addict by Dior. Vanilla and jasmine. So faint, I think I'm imagining it. I am imagining it, because even as I stand at the foot of the stairs, my eyes closed, I realize that I can't smell it at all.
Come on, you.
I unbuckle Ella from the car seat. Talking aloud to her quells the churning feeling in my stomach, as though 1,000 butterflies were caught in a net. Despite the ardor, the kitchen is icy too. There's a smell of fresh, cold air. A drift of jasmine I make myself ignore. Rita whines from the utility room. I open the door and go to fuss her, but she ignores me and runs into the kitchen, where she chases her nose in circles along the floor. Around and around she runs, and it makes me smile in spite of myself.
Silly dog, I say to Ella. Isn't she a silly dog?
I find a piece of marrow bone, and reluctantly, Rita leaves her imaginary rabbit chase and takes it to her bed by the arga, where she gnaws contentedly. Post-bereavement hallucinatory experiences. Such a clinical way to describe something so magical. So inexplicable. Some people claim to have had entire conversations with their loved ones, Mark said at the police station. It's often part of a disordered grieving process known as pathological grief, but occasionally it can be a symptom of something more serious. Symptoms, processes, conditions. Names for things we don't understand because we're frightened of what they might mean, what they might do to us. Entire conversations. I'd give anything to hear my parents' voices again. I have a few videos. Birthday speeches, summer holiday antics, a film from my graduation. Snippets recorded throughout the day, then stitched together. My parents are the wrong side of the camera. They kept it proudly trained on me. But the microphone picked up every whispered word as they sat in their front row seats in the Butterworth Hall at Warwick Arts Centre.
Our little girl. I can't believe it. Look at that one in the jeans. You'd think he'd have put a proper pair of trousers on. You can talk. You look like you've been gardening in those.
Well, how stupid of me. I thought today was about Anna. If I'd known it was a fashion parade for parents. They took me for lunch at Taylor's, where Dad became prouder and louder with each course, and Mum wiped tears away as she shared my mediocre degree result with another stranger. By dessert, I was desperate to leave, but I couldn't steal this moment from them. I was their only child. The first Johnson to go to university. They deserved a celebration. I've played the films so often I know every word by heart, but it isn't the same. It could never be the same. I close my eyes. tip up my head. On impulse, I hold out my arms, palms uppermost, thinking how if anyone looks in the window right now, I will never live this down. But if I can feel Mum, if I can smell her perfume. Mum? Dad? My voice sounds small and tinny in the empty kitchen. If you can hear me... There's a whistle of wind from outside, a rustle from the trees in the garden. Rita whines, a faint, high-pitched cry that fades into nothing. When I was 11, Laura showed me how to make a Ouija board, explaining how we could summon the dead with nothing more than some strategically lit candles and a board on which we had carefully marked the letters of the alphabet. She swore me to secrecy, and we waited until the next time Laura babysat to set everything up. Laura turned the lights low. She took a CD from her bag and played a track I didn't recognize, by an old-fashioned singer I'd never heard of. Ready? Our forefingers on the small piece of wood in the center of the board. We waited. And waited. I stifled the giggles. Laura's eyes were closed, her face screwed up in concentration. I was getting bored. I'd expected a fun night in with Laura, scaring each other with ghost stories, the way my friends and I did at sleepovers. I pushed the marker. Laura's eyes snapped open. I mirrored her look of shock. Did you feel that? I nodded furiously. She narrowed her eyes at me. Did you move it? Swear you didn't move it. I swear. Laura closed her eyes again. Is there someone there? Gently, I pushed the marker across the board. Yes. And then I wished I hadn't. Because Laura's face crumpled like paper, and tears pushed their way from beneath her eyelids and clung to her lashes. Mum? I wanted to cry too. I couldn't tell Laura I'd been messing around, but I couldn't carry on with a game she wasn't playing. Her fingers trembled, but the marker didn't move. It was an age before she took away her hands. Shall we play something else instead? Are you okay? I was tentative, but Laura had already blinked away the beginnings of tears. She blew out the candles, whisked me into a game of Monopoly. Years later, I confessed. We were sharing a bottle of wine, and I had a sudden memory of crouching over our homemade Ouija board, a sudden need to clear my conscience. I know, she said, when I'd unburdened my soul. You know? Well, I guessed. You were a crap liar when you were 11. She grinned and aimed a punch at my shoulder, then took in my face. Don't tell me it's been eating you up all this time. It hadn't, but I was relieved to discover that it hadn't been weighing on her mind either. Now, my skin prickles. The hairs on the back of my neck stand on end, one by one. I catch a trace of jasmine in my nostrils, and then... nothing. I open my eyes and drop my arms to my side, because this is absurd, ridiculous. My parents are dead, and I can no more summon them from my kitchen than I can spread wings and fly. There are no messages, no hauntings, no afterlife. Mark's right. It's all in my head. Chapter 21. Murray. I take it the husband doesn't believe in ghosts, Sarah said. They were sitting on the black leather sofa of Highfield's family room, where Murray had joined Sarah for the 45 minutes permitted for his evening meal break. Partner. No, he says they're post-bereavement hallucinatory experiences. Casper will be devastated. The door to the family room opened, and a young girl came in. She was so thin her head seemed disproportionately large, and a crisscross of fine scars covered her arms from wrist to shoulder. She didn't acknowledge Murray or Sarah, just picked up a magazine from the coffee table and took it back out of the room. According to Mark Hemmings, up to 60% of bereaved people report seeing or hearing a loved one after death, or sense their presence in some other way.